You're listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, and I'm joined today by my co-host, as usual, Prashant Parameswaran. And while Prashant and I usually do these podcasts between Washington, D.C. and New York City, Prashant's joining me from Hanoi, Vietnam. He's currently on an Asian tour and was actually recently in Singapore for the Shangri-La Dialogue, representing the Diplomat in his personal capacity. But Prashant, have your travels been so far?
Yeah, it's been great. As you mentioned, you know, I was in Singapore and Malaysia before that, in Hanoi now, and I'm going to be off to Jakarta tomorrow.
Awesome. Yeah. Like we said, you know, our tagline is Know the Asia Pacific. And I guess to know the Asia Pacific, you've got to sometimes make your way around the region. But Prashant, I'm really hoping to make the most of having you on to talk about the Shangri-La Dialogue. And just so listeners know, we will spend the second half of this podcast talking about Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's visit to the United States as well. But the Shangri-La Dialogue is obviously been in the headlines recently. It's one of the Asia Pacific's premier security dialogues, takes place every year in late May in Singapore. It's hosted by IISS, a think tank. And Prashant, essentially, you know, I'm just looking forward to hearing your general impressions of how things went. Obviously, there were several security topics at the top of the agenda, notably the South China Sea this year. But as you've also covered at The Diplomat, you know, other issues like trilateral patrols against pirates in the Sulu Sea have come up. North Korea has come up. So tell us a bit, what was it like for you to participate in the dialogue, and what really stood out in this year's Shangri-La Dialogue?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, Ankit, you know, the elephant in the room was the South China Sea, both in the formal sessions of the Shangri-La Dialogue as well as informal conversations among the delegates. With the incoming, you know, sort of the upcoming verdict on the arbitration case, that was no surprise. I think this year, the concern among countries about the issue, as well as the pressure on China to change its behavior in the South China Sea, was pretty clear. The call did not just come from the United States, but as you noted in one of your pieces on the dialogue, countries like France even referenced, you know, potential patrols in the South China Sea among European countries. So the international concern is palpable. I think it sort of foreshadows what might happen following the case, where the international community will try to articulate its displeasure about China's actions and paint Beijing's actions as isolating itself. Ash Carter, in his remarks, mentioned what he had said before, which is China is constructing a great wall of isolation from what he termed Asia's principal security network.
Right.
I thought the reaction from the Chinese appeared rather tone deaf to some of the delegates. The speech essentially continued to insist about China's historic rights in the South China Sea, and actually the Chinese admiral actually argued that the situation in the South China Sea was actually getting better relative to last year, which was. And I was sitting next to a number of the delegates when he said that, and there were a lot of puzzled looks about you know, where he was getting this information from, because any reading of the situation in the South China Sea would not determine that the situation has gotten any better in the last year or so.
Now, let me ask you, Prashant, in past years, what I've heard about the Chinese representatives at Shangri-La Dialogue is, A, China tends to send a more junior representative than other countries do. For example, the United States, several regional countries, even France, sent their defense ministers. China sent a deputy chief of the PLA, Admiral Sun Zheng, who is clearly a little bit more junior than the other representatives. So that's A. The second thing is, most Chinese representatives at Shangri-La will simply paper through their briefing books to answer any questions, essentially echoing what we hear at foreign ministry press conferences. So was that true this year as well, or did you notice a little bit more organic, of an organic touch in the Chinese approach?
I wouldn't say there was too much of a departure from the traditional Chinese approach, and to be honest, I wasn't surprised by the tone that they had adopted, because I think many people expected with the pending case, China would take a very cautious approach to what was going on. And I think the Chinese had an idea of what the Americans were going to say. So if I was surprised to any part of that, it was their reaction to the comment that they were isolated, because they had a little bit of time before the dialogue to fashion some kind of response that was very convincing. Their approach came off as very defensive. I think Ash Carter, very strategically, in my view, framed the South China Sea and China's actions not as something which is a U.S.-China issue or something where China's actions are undermining just international law, but he sort of said the United States and a number of other Asian countries, together with the international community, are building a security network in the region, and China has an opportunity to be part of it if it chooses to, but it is effectively excluding itself from that. Now, the Chinese response was sort of, well, we're not doing that. We're not isolated. And contrary to that, the South China Sea situation is actually getting better. We are engaged with countries. And it came off as, relative to what the United States and other countries were saying, a little bit more defensive and did not really articulate a clear, positive, inclusive vision for the region in the way that some other delegates, I think, were hoping. And the rather tone-deaf nature of the comments, I think, came through very clearly.
Right. And, I mean, that goes back to the broader charm offensive, I guess, China is on right now and trying to get, I guess, small states across the world mostly to back its position on the South China Sea, which is that the disputes should be resolved directly through negotiations between the parties involved. And,
Yeah, exactly.
China's, spoken on behalf of a bunch of countries. It claims to have a list of 40 countries that are backing its position. But, you don't really usually hear it from the countries themselves. You usually see it in the Chinese Foreign Ministry press conferences again. They'll say, we have, we've received support from these three countries, these five countries for our position on the South China Sea. Anyways, Prashant, I do also want to ask you about, some of the other security issues that came up. Notably, you brought up the issue of the Sulu Sea. For listeners, Prashant has an article at The Diplomat covering this angle of the Shangri-La dialogue, which hasn't been covered as widely in the broader press coverage, which mostly focused on the South China Sea component. So, Prashant, tell us a bit about that and the context there.
Yeah, so the broader context, I think, is the fact that I think several of the delegates at Shangri-La mentioned that there was a little bit of an overemphasis on the South China Sea relative to some of the other issues that the Southeast Asian countries and defense ministers highlighted. And several of the speeches, whether it was Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, repeatedly highlighted the wide range of threats that the region faces. So not only the South China Sea, but the Islamic State, piracy, trafficking. And I think in my piece, what I tried to mention was that the focus on the Sulu Sea, or the Sulu-Sulawesi Seas more extensively at the Shangri-La Dialogue, really attests to the broad range of threats that these countries are facing. So the trilateral patrols that you were mentioning that Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines agreed to in Laos on the sidelines of the ASEAN defense ministers meeting just a week before Shangri-La is a good example of how this is a very key front in maritime security in the region, and that even though the South China Sea is a major issue that gets a lot of attention, we should also not forget that there are other fronts that matter too. So the most prominent one would be the Malacca Straits, which is very strategically important, but there are other fronts as well, and the Sulu Sea is one of them where we do have to pay a lot of attention to it because of some of these challenges like piracy and trafficking, so on and so forth. And I think the conversations at the Shangri-La Dialogue definitely reflected that, even though a lot of the headlines coming out of the dialogue didn't necessarily reflect that more complex reality. The other thing I will say is that the Shangri-La Dialogue, as you know, Ankit, it's not only about the formal sessions and the informal dialogues that delegates have, it's also an opportunity for a lot of Track One meetings to take place because the defense ministers are
Right.
there. So, just ahead of the Shangri-La Dialogue on Friday, Singapore and India held their first ever defense dialogue meeting since the establishment of the mechanism last year during Modi's visit to Singapore, which, you know, is also an excellent segue to the next part of our podcast, which is
I did have one final question that I wanted to ask you though about the Shangri-La Dialect, if you don't mind. And this has been really, at the top of my mind because you talk to obviously a lot of people from a lot of Asian countries, and I wonder what you managed to hear in private conversations about the possibility of a Donald Trump presidency in the United States. Naturally, many U.S. partners in Asia are concerned, and I'm wondering, how you perceived that when you were in Singapore.
That is a very unfortunate reality that that set of conversations was one that we're forced to have as people traveling from the United States, even if we choose not to. The concern is palpable, and I think it each year, regardless of what the United States does, there's always perennial concerns about the sustainability of U.S. commitment, and that has to do with a lot of structural factors, including the fact that the United States is a global power. There's concerns about the amount of resources that the U.S. has to sustain its so-called rebalance to the Asia Pacific. And naturally, when you have the Obama administration winding down, there's always concerns about the next administration. I think the concern about the Trump presidency is real, primarily because, to put it very bluntly, it's not so much that that people think that we're going to have a broad swing towards a different kind of foreign policy, but they don't really know what to think because there's so many different things that are being said, and many of these conversations that you have sort of comes down to, well, who might his advisors be? What might be his position on some of the specific issues, whether it's the U.S.-Japan alliance, the South China Sea, and a lot of these questions, unfortunately, they're conjecture at this point, primarily because a lot of the things that he said about, for example, getting Japan or South Korea to pay more for their alliance commitments, or it's questioning the TPP, it's not clear whether he's going to actually be able to get these things through. You'll recall, for example, with respect to the alliances question, during the Jimmy Carter years, there was an effort. A similar effort under the United States back then to try to pull back from some of its alliances in the Asia Pacific. And that didn't last very long, primarily because A, there was a lot of resistance from the bureaucracy in Washington. And secondly, it became very clear, since we're in the midst of a Cold War back then, that when the United States tried to do that, there were a lot of destabilizing security trends that resulted that then forced Washington to pull back. So the key question going forward is the extent to which what Donald Trump is saying can actually be realized. And secondarily, if he is elected president, and I still think that's quite unlikely, how might the world respond if he continues on with some of these destabilizing policies? And I think the last thing I'll say is that people are thinking very realistically about the potential for a Trump presidency. This is not something where I think, several people in Washington still dismiss it as a very unlikely scenario and don't even think very strategically about it. I have to say, I was surprised by the degree to which many senior leaders and even scholars and experts are thinking very carefully in Asia about what it means.
Absolutely. And, I really like that in your analysis and your writing on foreign policy, Prashant, you come back to this idea of how a lot of foreign policy practices, particularly between countries that are close allies or partners, are heavily institutionalized within the bureaucracy. And it's often not really a sexy thing to talk about, but I think it is often very important. And you're right that oftentimes even a leader like Trump might not get exactly what he wants. And there are, those institutional constraints on what might be possible. Anyways, we can move the conversation forward now to Modi.
I wanted to ask you. I mean, this is the visit by Modi to Washington, and his address to Congress was something that was widely expected. As you mentioned in your piece on the key takeaways on U.S.-India relations after the meeting, this is not new in the sense that several other Indian leaders have addressed Congress before. But the context for the visit, particularly given the United States and the U.S. Congress's historical attitude towards Modi before he ascended to the leadership in India, makes this additionally more significant. And also the great momentum that we've seen in U.S.-India relations over the past few years under Modi also provides good context. So I'm wondering if you could tell us, what are the major takeaways from Modi's visit that you saw?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So basically, Modi was here for, he arrived on Monday night earlier this week, left on Wednesday afternoon after his congressional speech. His visit essentially had two major components. One was his meeting with Obama, which was probably the last state visit between the two leaders. And that produced a pretty lengthy joint statement, like we've seen between Modi and Obama for the past 2 years, since 2014, when Modi was elected in India. So, as I noted in my takeaways, Prashant, if I had to kind of give a thematic overview of what this visit meant for the broader U.S.-India bilateral, and you know, for how Modi views the partnership with the U.S., really, I mean, Modi is realizing a lot of potential that has existed in the U.S.-India relationship for some time, since at least the early years of the Bush administration, but it hasn't really seen, the light of day. For example, the civil nuclear agreement between India and the United States, which is rightly pointed out as one of the watershed moments, not only for Indian foreign policy, but for the bilateral relationship more broadly, it really hasn't paid any dividends for the United States. India has seen some benefits. India really managed to, enjoy some of the perks of being a normal nuclear state, even though it exists largely outside of the framework of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, as a result of U.S. support following the 2005 deal, which was eventually ratified in 2008. But for U.S. nuclear providers, for example, they haven't really been able to set up shop in India. So that was one of the big takeaways of this visit, is that finally, building on the agreement on nuclear supplier liability that Obama and Modi ironed out last year when Obama visited India in January, the two leaders essentially announced that Westinghouse will be setting up six nuclear reactors in India, which is, both a very good thing for India, which is an energy-starved country and could benefit from nuclear power, but also for U.S. suppliers. I mean, the civil nuclear deal was supposed to pay dividends for U.S. suppliers. It's just taken a lot longer than a lot of people thought. And the other big takeaway, this is on defense, and specifically, Obama announced that India is now what's called a major defense partner, which is a designation that really seems to be a bespoke status for India. No other country has been called a major defense partner by the United States. At least that's what came up in my research. So essentially, it's something like, I guess Washington didn't quite want to give India the major non-NATO ally designation. India has its own reservations about being called an ally. While bipartisan consensus might largely exist in the United States about the value of the relationship with India, that's not necessarily reciprocated in New Delhi, where there are some skeptics about the value of convergence with the United States. But essentially, with this new major defense partner status, India will have access to U.S. military technology at the same level as Washington's closest allies. And we'll see how that plays out in practice. I am, a little skeptical. I don't quite see the United States and India kind of carrying out the same sort of deals that the United States might be carrying out with Japan, for example. But the potential now is certainly there. And particularly for, some very specific things. I won't get too in the weeds on this podcast, but there are some very specific technologies that India is very interested in, like EMALS for its second indigenous aircraft carrier. Essentially, no Eastern Navy operates a carrier that uses catapult launch systems. All of them have ski jump carriers. China has ski jump carriers. India has ski jump carriers. If India managed to procure this technology from the United States, essentially its carrier sortie rates at sea would be significantly improved. The stress on the airframes of India's carrier fighters would be significantly better as well. So there are, these real dividends that could end up paying out in the future. One final note on defense is that Obama and Modi finalized the text for a logistics support agreement, now called the Logistics Exchange Memorandum of Agreement. That still has to be signed, but the fact that the text is finalized is actually a really big milestone. That agreement has been underway for over a decade as well. So you see why I come back to this theme of realizing on long existing potential. To talk about the congressional address, like you said, former, Indian prime ministers have done this in the past. India is actually, we've seen the same number of Indian and German prime leaders now make speeches before joint sessions of Congress now, which tells you a bit about where India is falling in terms of the broader U.S. foreign policy radar. But Modi essentially offered a very forward-looking vision of the bilateral relationship, calling the two countries indispensable partners, natural allies. He was very effusive, really, you know, essentially he cast off the hesitations of history, I think he called it, essentially acknowledging that India and the United States have had their difficulties in the past, but going forward, you know, India is looking to sign up to that principled security network that you talked about, for example. And Modi right. spoke out in support of the status quo rules-based order, freedom of navigation, all that good stuff, criticized terrorism and countries that harbor terrorism, which was a not very veiled attempt at toward Pakistan. And Modi, you know, has obviously seen that Congress is a particularly good forum for that, since the recent F-16 deal between the United States fell apart after congressional criticism. So, you know, those are some of my big observations on this deal. There are there is a lot more depth to this relationship now. And, you know, other major issues like agreements on climate change, Obama managed to pull India firmly into mm-hmm. the framework that was established in Paris last November and December. So there's really a lot going on in this relationship now. And basically, with the Obama administration winding down, it looks like the India-U.S. relationship has just seen a major inflection point with this visit. And we'll look forward to seeing how it evolves from here on out.
Yeah, I'd one further question for you. One of the things that I noticed about your piece, and I noted that it was very, very interesting as well, was relatively speaking, compared to past U.S.-India statements, the lack of depth on global issues. And I like the way you put it in your piece, which is it seemed like the statement seemed to trade global scope for bilateral depth. And you noted specific examples of that, including the position on the South China Sea, which is really interesting given India's recent signing on to the trilateral statement with China and Russia that you also wrote about. I'm wondering if you could give some broader context for readers about that and the context for that.
Yeah. So basically every major U.S.-India bilateral statement in the Modi era has featured some pretty detailed you know, statements and declarations on global challenges like Afghanistan, North Korea, freedom of navigation in the South China Sea. This statement included a lot less of that. There was still some specific call out. Africa actually got a pretty specific call out from, you know, both countries pledged to increase their cooperation right. with African countries. The South China Sea issue is interesting. I think India muddied its position a bit by agreeing to sign on to that Russia-China trilateral statement, since India's longstanding position that Indian leaders have reiterated alongside their U.S. counterparts, Vietnamese counterparts, and other Southeast Asian counterparts was that India supports the peaceful resolution of these disputes through international arbitration. But India signed on to the broader Chinese statement that essentially said these disputes should be resolved bilaterally through negotiations. So I think, you know, there is also a broader context. One of the issues I didn't really want to get too much into in the podcast is India's ongoing application to the Nuclear Suppliers Group, which mm-hmm. is a 48-nation group that India is hoping to join, which would give it access to broader nuclear commerce. India managed to get a waiver from the group in 2008, partly as a result of its nuclear deal with the United States. But essentially, China holds the keys to India's membership at the NSG, which is what most experts think, and China isn't really poised right now to vote affirmatively for India's membership. And I think, you know, India might simply have been willing to avoid naming the South China Sea before the plenary later this month, just to avoid riling up China more than necessary.
Right.
But I fully expect, you know, once the arbitration decision comes out, that India will clarify its position. And I suspect that it'll probably go with the position that we've seen more from New Delhi, which is that it supports international law and arbitration in the South China Sea, not necessarily China's position.
Right.
Yeah, well, Prashant, I think we should wrap this up, and I know you have a lot of traveling ahead of you, and I will just end with a few housekeeping notes, which is that you might have noticed that this podcast, the audio quality sounds a little bit better. That's because I've upgraded my podcasting setup, so hopefully going forward, the listening experience will be a lot more positive for all of our listeners. And speaking of, make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so you don't miss future episodes. And really, I'm trying to solicit more listener feedback on future topics. So if you really have, you know, any grinding questions about geopolitical issues in the Asia Pacific, possibly something historical, since I do tend to base the agenda more around the news cycle, definitely, you know, either shoot me an email, ankit@thediplomat.com, or you can find me on Twitter. I'm sure Prashant would be happy to field those queries as well. Prashant, sorry, I'm signing you up for that. Yeah, thanks for listening, and definitely do stay tuned for more on this podcast. Thanks.